What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome. Before we jump into this week's episode, I wanted to let you know that bonus episode number 52 is out now. Our patrons get to vote on what stories they want to hear, and this one won by a landslide. We're discussing the bizarre case of the Tromp family mystery. In August of 2016, the Tromp family mysteriously fled their successful berry farm in Sylvan, Australia, on a spontaneous off-grid road trip without cell phones, credit cards, or passports. Over a six-day period, they split up and were eventually found scattered across multiple states in paranoid, catatonic, or agitated states. It's definitely an interesting one, so go to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast to get access to that episode and 51 others. But with that said, why don't we jump into this week's story? This case contains graphic details that may be distressing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Cece Opanowski grew up in the small town of Hudson Falls in upstate New York. When Cece was 15 years old and a sophomore in high school, she met 16-year-old Sean Doyle. Sean was nice to Cece, and she really liked him, so they quickly began dating, and they soon did everything together. At first, everything seemed like innocent puppy love, and things were great. But Sean was going through some troubles at home. During his junior year, he told Cece his parents had kicked him out and he had nowhere to go. So Cece begged her parents to let him move in with them. Her parents agreed to let Cece's boyfriend move in with them, but soon after he moved in, Cece began seeing a change in Sean. He wasn't the same loving, kind boyfriend he'd always been. He became jealous and possessive, secretly following Cece around just to keep tabs on her, which at the time she didn't really see as a big deal. She was only a teenager, 16 years old, and she felt like his jealousy was just a sign that he loved her so much. When he followed her home, that was just because he was worried about her. She was able to brush off these red flags pretty easily at the time. But in reality, his behaviors were much more sinister than that, and as an adult, she can look back on those times and see them for what they really were, controlling and very concerning. And as time went on, Sean became even more possessive. He even tattooed a heart on his arm with Cece's name in the middle. And Cece was not happy about that. When she saw it, she got really freaked out and asked him why he had done that, and he told her it was because he loved her so much. But even at 16 years old, that was a red flag for Cece. That would certainly freak me out at 16 years old, or honestly, probably any age. It's a bit much for my taste. Around the same time, during his senior year, Sean dropped out of high school and began working odd jobs that he couldn't hold down. And it was around then that things began getting even darker. Sean didn't have any prospects, and Cece was getting ready to go off to school and live a life without him. To him, his whole life was about to change. Cece's as well. But it was a different change. Her future was looking brighter, while Sean's darkness only grew. But even still, she stuck by him. And in their senior yearbook, under her photo, she wrote a paragraph that included, "I love you, Sean," at the end. In the summer of 1995, when she left home to attend Russell Sage College in Albany, they agreed to do long distance and see each other on weekends. But at the end of September, Cece told Sean that she wouldn't be coming home every weekend to see him. And he didn't like that. He showed up to her dorm and stood outside threatening that he was going to kill her or anyone who got close to her. If he couldn't have her, no one could. It was a definite escalation in his behavior, and it was getting really scary. So Cece called the cops, and Sean was arrested and charged with harassment and trespassing. And that was Cece's final straw. She broke things off with him for good, and he moved out of her parents' house. But that wouldn't be the last straw for Sean. He continued to call and harass her all the time. But even though Sean threatened Cece, she never looked at him as if he were going to actually physically harm her. She didn't believe he was capable of something like that. She had loved him for a time, and she couldn't wrap her head around someone she loved doing something so violent.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for. With SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
In January of 1996, Cece had just finished her first semester of college. She and Sean had been broken up for about 4 months by that point. And that weekend, her mother was going away, so she had the whole house to herself. And she planned to have her best friend and roommate, Shannon, come over to her home for a girls' night. Shannon also went to Sage Junior College, where she met Cece, as they were roommates, and they got along instantly. Shannon was an introvert, but Cece was really outgoing and bubbly, and she brought Shannon out of her shell. They always had a really good time together. It was winter and really cold out, so they just wanted to chill out and have a good time at home. They built a fire, and her parents had this great stereo system, so they were listening to music really loud and danced around and just had a really girly night. And as perfect as that sounds, things did get interrupted a handful of times by Sean. When Shannon first met Cece, Sean was still in her life, and she really didn't like him. Shannon thought he was really obnoxious. She would also watch Cece argue a lot with Sean on the phone before she inevitably ended their relationship, which she was in full support of. But like I said earlier, Sean continued to call and harass Cece all the time, and that night was no exception. Sean kept calling Cece. He wanted to know what they were doing and if he could come over, which definitely was not the vibe. So Shannon told Cece to just turn her cell phone off and ignore him. But Cece told Shannon she couldn't do that. If she turned her phone off, he'd definitely come over. So she continued to entertain Sean's annoying frequent calls, but overall, that night ended up being fine. The girls eventually went to sleep, and when they woke up in the morning, all they wanted to do was go grab some coffee. But Shannon didn't want to go out looking like a slob, so since she lived nearby, she told Cece that she was just going to run home really quickly to change into different clothes. When Shannon left, Cece got up and hung around the house watching TV and just being a regular teenager at home alone. And eventually, she heard a knock at the door, probably expecting it to be Shannon once again. But when she opened the door, she was met by Sean Doyle on her front step. He told Cece he just wanted to talk to her. So, unsure of what to do, Cece let him in. They had only been broken up for a few months, and he had lived there before, so it wasn't like it was strange to have him in the house. And again, as obnoxious as he was being, she never feared Sean. But when she let him in, things immediately shifted. Sean pushed Cece down onto the couch and grabbed her to hold her down and began yelling in her face. He then picked her up and pushed her up against the French doors and continually banged her body into the doors as he screamed at her. Once Shannon had gotten out of the shower and was ready to get some coffee, she called Cece, but nobody answered. And that was odd, because she knew Cece was there alone. But she figured maybe Cece got in the shower or something. Meanwhile, Cece's attack was only escalating. She had been wearing her hair in a ponytail, which Sean grabbed and picked her up by her hair and held her there for a second before he cut her hair off. He then began choking her, and Cece was terrified that Sean was going to stab her with the scissors he had used to cut her hair. At one point, he actually held the scissors to her neck and threatened to slit her throat. 30 minutes after the first call, Shannon called once again, and when Cece still didn't answer, she began getting slightly concerned. Cece was in complete shock and was doing everything she could to stay alive at that point, but throughout the entire attack, the phone was continually ringing. It wouldn't get answered, and then another call would come through. Shannon had waited a few minutes between calls and then would call again. And after quite a few calls, Cece explained to Sean if she didn't answer the phone, her mother would call the police. She probably knew that it was Shannon, but she definitely didn't want Sean to know that. And thankfully, that scared him enough to let her answer the phone. When Cece answered, she heard Shannon on the other line, who asked, "Hey, are you okay?" and Cece didn't know why she did this, but she began unloading the dishwasher as she responded, "No, no, yeah, everything is fine, no, no, no," and she kept responding with no in the response. She was saying she was okay, but she kept saying no, hoping that Shannon would catch on to this double meaning. Sean hadn't picked up on what Cece was doing, but thankfully Shannon had, and when Cece picked up the phone, Shannon could instantly hear the fear in her voice, and she knew that Sean had been harassing Cece. He'd called multiple times only the night before. So Shannon asked Cece, "Is he there?" And Cece said, "Yes." So Shannon hung up the phone and called the cops, and then rushed over to Cece's house herself. And minutes later, the police were at Cece's house. When Shannon pulled up to Cece's house and parked, the police were already pulling Sean outside. Shannon rushed in after that, and she said Cece looked terrified, angry, and sad all at once. She knew that her life was different from that point on. And not only that, but when the police had arrived, she initially felt relieved. She thought they would make her feel safe, but in reality, their response was terrible. First of all, they didn't put Sean in handcuffs. And even worse than that, they put Cece in the back of the police car with Sean. Based on her appearance, there was no question that Cece had been assaulted. She had been hit multiple times and her hair had been cut off. But even still, they put her in the back of the police car with Sean and took her to the police station with him and then put her in the same room as him for questioning. They were questioned together. And it was obvious that they were treating this as if it were some innocent spat between two teenagers that turned a little bit dark. 48 Hours covered this story, and when they reached out to Hudson Falls Police Department, they did acknowledge that law enforcement's response to domestic violence has evolved over the past several decades to better work with and support victims. Which is good to hear, because what Cece had to go through is actually ridiculous. They were supposed to make her feel safe, and they did the complete opposite. Making it out to be just a spat between an 18-year-old boyfriend and girlfriend, of course, minimizes the whole thing, but also, it places some of the blame on Cece, as if she had an equal part in this. Also, even if it was, quote-unquote, just an argument, no spat between two partners should ever get physical, and Cece had clearly been attacked and her hair had been chopped off. There was nothing minor about this. So I am glad to hear that they recognized that what they did was bad, but them saying that all these years later didn't help Cece any. Thankfully, she had Shannon, because if Shannon hadn't picked up on what Cece was doing, there is a very good possibility that Cece wouldn't have even been alive to tell her tale in the first place. It's honestly kind of incredible that Shannon had even picked up on it, because Cece had been saying that she was okay. Of course, she probably sounded weird, because Shannon had literally just been there, and Cece's energy was, I'm sure, completely shifted. But Shannon did say that she had people in her life where this sort of thing happened, so it seems like she had been exposed to some sort of domestic violence situation in the past, and that is kind of what informed her response and what probably made her so perceptive in that moment, which is a huge deal that she was able to save Cece's life, basically. Maybe it wouldn't have gotten that far, but there's a very good chance that it would have, based off of what Sean Doyle would do in the future. So police arrested Doyle and charged him with menacing, harassment, and criminal trespassing. Another terrible part about how the police handled this situation was Cece began to doubt herself. She felt crazy. She didn't know how this kind of thing could have happened to her, and she questioned her reality. But after the attack, Cece returned to college and finished up her freshman year. But Shannon noticed that she was different. It had a major effect on her mental health. She was constantly looking over her shoulder and bought herself a Swiss Army knife to protect herself. She began having night terrors and waking up crying or screaming, and that was when she could manage to fall asleep in the first place. She was going through an awful time. 8 months after the attack was when it was time to take it to trial. But Cece, who was only 19 years old, wanted nothing to do with it. She told prosecutors she couldn't go through with testifying against Sean. She was too traumatized and still scared of him. She also didn't want to keep reliving everything that had happened to her. She just wanted it all to go away. So Sean was offered a deal. He pled guilty to menacing in the second degree and was sentenced to 3 years probation. Cece transferred colleges and moved hours away from Hudson Falls to be far away from Sean. She tried her best to move on, but she was haunted by a conversation she had with a prosecutor. She had told Cece, based on what she saw in this case, Sean was going to do this again to another person. This was when the prosecutor was trying to get Cece to testify against Sean, and ultimately Cece decided not to. But this warning stuck in her head for over 2 decades. All she could do was hope that that wouldn't be the case. But sadly, that prosecutor was right. And tragically, Sean's other victim wouldn't be as lucky as Cece had been. 9 years after Cece left upstate New York, 33-year-old Lori Leonard disappeared. Lori Leonard was a single mother who was living in Chittenango, a small town outside of Syracuse, New York, with her 2 sons, Austin, who was 9 at the time, and Zachary, who was 5. Lori was an amazing mother, and her sons adored her. They loved spending time, just the 3 of them, but Lori dreamed of having a home with a father figure for her kids. She dreamed of having a white picket fence kind of life for her and her kids. Lori was very close with her older sister, Jennifer. They were best friends. But Jennifer also took on a motherly role in Lori's life. And she did admit she could be a bit bossy to Lori at times. She was pretty overprotective, so when Lori met a man on a dating website, Jennifer was immediately skeptical. This was still when online dating was very new, so she wasn't sure about the whole thing even before she met her sister's new boyfriend.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Lori met Sean Doyle on Cupid.com. And according to Jennifer, Sean wasn't very charismatic or social. She said, quote, "He was just kind of like a piece of furniture that you walked around." So needless to say, she had no idea what her sister saw in Sean. But Lori saw the good in everyone and told her sister that Sean was just misunderstood and shy. But other than that, Jennifer really didn't know much about him because Lori didn't talk about him much. And when she did see him, he didn't really say much. She only really knew that he lived 3 hours away in Hudson Falls and worked at an ice cream factory. She also mentioned that Sean was on probation, but she assured her sister it wasn't for anything bad. The story Sean told Lori was he was a boxer, and he was protecting a woman at a bar and was arrested because he used some of his professional boxing moves, which is not at all how that would work. But Lori chose to believe him. Jennifer, on the other hand, had never seen anything that made her believe that Sean Doyle was a professional boxer. She didn't buy any of the stories that he was selling Lori. What Jennifer was sure of was that after Lori met Sean, she became more distant. Before Sean, Jennifer would talk to Lori somewhere around 3 times a day. But once she was in a relationship with him, she didn't hear from her sister nearly as much. Which isn't necessarily a red flag. I mean, when you are in a relationship with someone, maybe you go through ebbs and flows of like being close to certain people in your life. But Jennifer knew that this was out of character for Lori, and then it got worse. One night Jennifer called Lori, and all she could hear in the background was that Sean was yelling at Lori. And that was extremely alarming. She asked Lori what was going on, and Lori told Jennifer it wasn't a big deal, she'd just have to call her back. What scared Jennifer the most was the fact that Sean stopped right when he realized he had been caught yelling at Lori. She was worried about what was going on behind closed doors at that point. What was Lori going through that Jennifer had no idea about? How often was he yelling at her like that? Sean was sneaky, and Jennifer really didn't like it. But soon after that, Lori ended things with Sean. She told Jennifer that she and Sean agreed to just be friends, and he was apparently fine with that. But once again, Jennifer wasn't buying it. He wasn't the type of guy that would have been okay with just being friends. And despite the breakup, Sean still frequently drove 3 hours to visit Lori, and would often just hang out at the bar where she waitressed late at night. At the same time, Sean had made a friend named Dorothy Tucker. She lived down the street from Sean in Hudson Falls, and she considered him to be a close friend. He would call her and ask for advice on things pretty regularly, and Dorothy thought that Sean was a sweet guy that would bend over backwards for her if she needed him to. But after his and Lori's relationship ended, he confided in Dorothy that he had been following Lori and watched her as she went out on a date. Dorothy told him he couldn't do that. That was creepy. And also, Lori didn't want to be with him. She wasn't necessarily concerned about Sean's behavior because she thought she knew who he was, and he was just taking their breakup really hard. Because Sean agreed with Dorothy that he shouldn't do that again, so it seemed fine. But things were certainly not fine. On Friday, April 29th, 2005, Lori, who had been living with Jennifer, moved to a new apartment on her own, and she was really excited to start this new chapter of her life. Her nephew, Dustin, who was 15 at the time, helped Lori move, but she needed more help than just him, so after asking other people in her life who turned her down, she ended up having to ask Sean for help since she really needed it and they were still friends. He also had a pickup truck, which is very helpful in a move. Sean had been playing nice because he was really trying to weasel his way back into Lori's life, but that day, Dustin said Sean was pretty standoffish and quiet. The move went pretty smoothly until Sean decided he was just gonna stay at Lori's house. He decided that he was going to stay with Lori in her new place for a few days, which was an insane thing to do, but I guess Lori felt bad because she had just asked him for help with this move and he wasn't leaving. So I guess she just didn't really know what to do at this point. But after a few days, Sean really began getting on Lori's nerves. 5 whole days after the move, Lori told Jennifer that Sean was finally leaving because she had plans to go to Albany for the afternoon to pick up tickets to a Yankees game. She was feeling really relieved that she had something to go and do, and there was no reason for him to stay, and he kind of took the hint he was leaving. And Lori was really excited about these tickets. They were a gift from someone that she met at work, and she was really looking forward to going to this game. Jennifer was a little concerned that Lori needed to go all the way to Albany to pick up these tickets from someone she didn't even know, but Lori wasn't worried. She was a very trusting person. On Wednesday, May 4th, Jennifer called Lori in the afternoon, hoping to catch her while she was on her way to Albany. But every time she called, it would go straight to voicemail, which was extremely odd. Lori's phone was never off, and they talked all the time. At first, Jennifer thought Lori may have gotten lost on her drive, or maybe her phone had died, but no part of her was thinking that something bad had happened. It was just weird. But 24 hours later, that changed. When Lori never called or returned home, Jennifer called the Chittenango police. And patrol began looking into her whereabouts, while lead investigator Wade Irwin went to Lori's apartment to check things out himself. It was apparent that she had just moved into this apartment. There were still a ton of boxes everywhere, and it looked like she had been in the process of unpacking right before she had gone missing. It didn't appear that there was any kind of break-in or crime that had taken place in her home, but her car was there. And there was one other unsettling thing that stuck out to him. There was one shoe in the center of the bed. That stuck out to Detective Irwin as odd. Even though she had been in the process of unpacking, it looked out of place. And Detective Irwin was determined to speak to one person in particular. The last person to have seen Lori was Sean Doyle. But before investigators even got a chance to call Sean, Jennifer managed to track down his number and called him herself. She asked Sean if he had spoken to Lori, and he told her no, he hadn't heard from her in a couple of days. He asked Jennifer, wasn't she supposed to get tickets the other night? And Jennifer told him, yeah, she was, but she hadn't heard from her since. And if she called him, to let her know because her phone was obviously off. And Sean told her he would. But Jennifer said when she hung up with Sean, she got full body chills because she knew he was lying. He knew something about where Lori was. And as days went on, Chittenango investigators reached out to everyone who had contact with Lori prior to her disappearance. They also checked in on the man Lori was supposed to have gotten Yankees tickets from in Albany. He was an executive for a company, so they were able to track him down and interview him pretty easily. The man told police he waited for Lori in Albany, and when she never showed up, he called her and left a message. He was even concerned, saying in the message that he had the tickets and was waiting for her, and he hoped everything was okay, and that she didn't get into an accident or something along the way. Police, of course, looked into him further, and his alibi checked out. When police got a hold of Lori's phone records, they found something else that was pretty interesting. Or rather, the lack of something was telling. They noticed that Sean Doyle, who was supposedly very concerned about Lori's whereabouts, hadn't called or left her a message. Investigators were immediately skeptical of Sean Doyle, and when they went to interview him, he told them on the day she disappeared, he had left her apartment around 3 p.m. and then drove 3 hours home to Hudson Falls. But when they checked his alibi, they couldn't clear him. Yet Sean was being cooperative and even allowed investigators to check his truck and take photos. Initially, they found nothing of note in Sean's truck. But when they searched the glove compartment, they found something strange. There was a key with a serial number on it, which could have been nothing. But also they made note of it because it could have been relevant to this case. And just like the shoe in the middle of the bed, this key stuck out to investigators. Sadly, Lori's sons were beginning to figure out that something had happened to their mother. It had been weeks of them asking where she was, and it was apparent that something was wrong. At this point, because they were so young, their family members didn't want to tell them the truth before they had confirmation that she was actually dead. So they would tell the boys that their mother was lost, but they were going to find her. To make matters even worse, Austin and Zachary were separated because they were both staying with their fathers. So they only got to see each other on weekends. They had lived together their whole lives, and now everything had changed in an instant, and their mother was nowhere to be found. Jennifer and her family were doing everything they could to find Lori, and she still wholeheartedly believed Sean Doyle had something to do with it. So weeks after Lori's disappearance, she went hours away to Hudson Falls and held a demonstration, hoping someone there would know something that would be usable for investigators. They had posters and signs which included Sean's name on them, basically asking the public to give them any information and directly calling him out. It was extremely badass, but Dorothy Tucker, who was friends with Sean at the time, said she heard Lori's family was in town and she immediately called Sean to let him know what they were doing. She also wanted to know what the hell was going on and asked if he had done anything, which Sean of course adamantly denied. And Dorothy believed him because they were such close friends. Sean told Dorothy he had no idea where Lori was and that she was probably off somewhere on a beach with some other guy, which angered both of them. Sean was acting angry as if Lori had been moving on and Dorothy was angry for him. And when Dorothy went into town and passed Lori's family rallying on the street, she yelled out the window of her car at them to go home. Sean didn't do anything and they needed to leave. That is a decision that she has come to deeply regret. But at the time, she wholeheartedly believed Sean and thought these people were smearing his good name, which I think goes to show how manipulative and charming Sean Doyle must have been when he wanted to be. He had her fooled, and he had Lori fooled for a portion of time, but after long enough, his true colors would eventually show through. And then months went by, still with no answers, and Lori's family began losing all hope. Detective Wade Irwin had made a promise to them to find a resolution and give them the closure and answers they so desperately needed. Every night he would call them and give updates, regardless of whether it was positive or negative. And then on July 24, 2005, 3 months after Lori went missing, Washington County Sheriff's Office got a call from a local fisherman. Captain Tony LeClaire received the information that this fisherman found a toolbox that goes in the back of a pickup truck, floating in the Champlain Lock Canal area. At the time he found it, he thought he had just gotten lucky, because he could use something like that. So he attached it to his boat and towed it with him about a mile and a half, and then dragged it out of the water himself. But once he got it on land, he found that the box had been locked, and it was emitting a strange and foul smell. And that was when he called the police. When they broke open the lock, authorities found a body wrapped in bedding. There were also pillows and a purse inside. And just inside the purse, right at the top, was Lori Leonard's ID. They also found in the box was a photo of Lori's two young sons. Her hands had been handcuffed behind her back. There was duct tape around the handcuffs. Her feet had been bound together and duct taped. Her face from chin to forehead had also been covered in duct tape. Once the tape had been removed, they also found a bandana tied in her mouth. and the medical examiner determined that Lori died of asphyxiation. Jennifer couldn't even grasp what investigators told her about how they found her sister. She didn't know how something like that could even happen, and she couldn't accept it. That was when Sean Doyle went from a person of interest to a suspect in this case. Everything started to come together very quickly, and within hours of finding Lori's body, police had a search warrant for Sean's home.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
During their search, police found sand tubes in his garage that matched the sand tubes found inside the toolbox that were being used to weigh it down in the water. They also found a similar set of handcuffs in his home, along with bandanas and duct tape. They were also able to make sense of the key that they had discovered in Sean Doyle's truck during the initial voluntary search. It matched the lock on the toolbox. So there is no way he thought the police would ever find this toolbox, because he didn't even bother getting rid of the key before police searched his truck, which he allowed them to do. It was fantastic for investigators because that tied him directly to this crime. The sand tubes, bandana, and duct tape, while compelling, wouldn't have been nearly as compelling as this key. He couldn't argue away the fact that this key in his possession matched the lock on the toolbox where Lori's body had been found. An argument could have potentially been made that the sand tubes matched, but they weren't the same sand tubes, and sure, he had bandanas, but so many people do. There's ways to argue around those certain things, but that key fit in that lock, and there was no other key that would have fit. When investigators checked the bridge near the canal where the toolbox was found, they discovered scratches on the bridge railing that matched the scratches found on the bottom of the toolbox. So they believed Sean Doyle came to the bridge with his pickup truck and pushed the toolbox over the edge into the canal. Only a day after the discovery of Lori's body, investigators arrested Sean Doyle, which was an overwhelming and bittersweet moment for Detective Irwin. He was very glad to get Lori's family the answers they so desperately wanted, but the way Lori had been found was so horrific. And at that point, now that they did finally have confirmation of Lori's death, it was time to break the news to Lori's sons. Even though Zachary was only 5 years old, he still remembers the moment when he was told that his mother was gone for good. He said he felt it as soon as he walked into the room. And then his father told him that his mother wasn't going to be coming home. Austin said he can also still feel that moment. He was 9 years old at the time, and it hit him extremely hard. Jennifer said she couldn't truly mourn her sister because she put all of her energy into preparing for Sean's trial. She was going to make sure that he got what he deserved. In late summer of 2005, Cece Opanowski received a phone call from her father, who informed her that her ex-boyfriend Sean had just been arrested for murder. And Cece couldn't believe it. Even though she had lived through Sean's cruelty, she still couldn't wrap her mind around the fact that he had killed someone. And when she learned that Sean's victim had been 33-year-old Lori Leonard, a single mother of two young boys, she was overwhelmed with guilt. Her heart broke for Lori's family, and she was haunted by the choice she made to not face Sean at trial all those years ago. She was a traumatized teenager then, but now she knew if she could go back, she would have done things very differently. She would have pursued the harshest punishment she could possibly get for Sean for what he did to her. But she couldn't go back in time. All she could do was move forward with this information. Only weeks later, investigators reached out to Cece and asked if she would be willing to speak out against Sean at his upcoming trial, and she immediately agreed. She was determined to put him behind bars for as long as she possibly could. The feeling she felt at that point was rage. The fear was long gone. And it turned out Cece wasn't Sean's only ex-girlfriend who would be testifying against him. 5 years after Sean had attacked Cece, he had allegedly attempted to kill his next girlfriend, 23-year-old Sarah Valmer. Sarah had alleged that Sean had tied her up with shoelaces, put duct tape over her mouth, and began strangling her until she passed out. The only reason the attack ended was because her mother had actually walked in on him. At the time, Sean had been charged with unlawful imprisonment in the second degree and assault in the third degree. But again, a deal was made, so Sean walked. He pled guilty to only the charge of unlawful imprisonment, and once again, Sean was sentenced to only 3 years of probation. It was horrendous. This mother walked in on her daughter being almost murdered by her boyfriend, and he only got 3 years of probation and was free and out in society and could do this to someone else. It was terrifying. But now she, too, was going to testify against Sean Doyle. On January 23, 2006, Sean Doyle's trial began. And when he entered the courtroom that day, Jennifer said she was surprised at the state of him. His appearance had changed quite a bit. She said he looked like a choir boy. He'd grown out his hair and had a sweater on, which was something that he would have never worn before now. He was a rough around the edges, bandana-wearing, jerky guy. This choir boy appearance was very much just put on to have good appearances for the jury and the judge. And she knew that, but they didn't. Kevin Courtwright had only been district attorney for less than a month at the time that this case went to trial. He said the key to this case was making sure that Cece and Sarah would be allowed to testify. Oftentimes, judges won't allow a defendant's prior bad acts to be brought up in trial. So there was no guarantee at this point that Cece would even get her day in court. But they were extremely crucial to this case because it showed the jury that Sean Doyle had a pattern. He had done almost the same thing in the past, and this new cleaned-up appearance didn't reflect the monster that was sitting in front of them. Despite the defense's objection, the judge thankfully ruled that Cece and Sarah could both testify. But first, D.A. Courtwright presented the jury with all of the pieces of physical evidence they had that pointed to Sean Doyle, which were pretty hard to argue with already. The sand tubes, the handcuffs, the duct tape, the key, the bandana, there was so much there. Sean wore a bandana basically 24 hours a day. He had bandanas in his bedroom, his truck, they were all around. And D.A. Courtwright told the jury he believed the bandana found in Lori's mouth had been the one he was wearing that day. Courtwright also called a clerk from a local AutoZone to talk about the toolbox. She told the jury that she had sold Sean that toolbox only 1 week before Lori had disappeared. She identified Sean perfectly and was even able to identify the shirt that he had been wearing that day. But the strongest piece of physical evidence they had was, of course, the key they found in Sean's car that matched the toolbox. But next up, Courtwright called Sean's previous close friend, Dorothy Tucker, who at that point had come to understand who Sean Doyle really was. And she ended up being a major witness for the prosecution because she provided information as to how they believed Sean Doyle transported Lori's body from Chittenango 3 hours to Hudson Falls after he murdered her. On his way to Hudson Falls, Sean continuously called Dorothy Tucker. And she told the jury the day Lori disappeared, Sean had actually stopped by her house, and in the back of his truck was a very large cardboard box. So seeing that cardboard box, she asked him, "Sean, what do you got there?" He told her it was just junk and garbage he had at Lori's, and he was planning to take it to the dump. Courtwright told the jury that he believed Lori's body had actually been in that cardboard box, and at some point he transferred her over to the toolbox. Dorothy also testified after that visit, Sean had shown up at her home again, and the cardboard box had been replaced by a large toolbox. She walked outside when Sean arrived and once again asked him a question about it. This time it was, "Hey Sean, what do you need a toolbox for? You don't have any tools to put in it." And he laughed and said, yeah, you know, me and a friend are going to go fishing by the Champlain Lock Canal area. It was a place he knew well and frequented often. He had even taken Cece there many times while they were dating. Not only had he been traipsing around with a body in his trunk, but he actually told Dorothy where he was going to put Lori's body, in the Champlain Lock Canal area. It's so ridiculous, but at the same time, it's of course a good thing that he was that dumb of a criminal. because it ended in him being arrested the day after they discovered Lori's body. So it is a good thing. But it's just kind of shocking how stupid and also cocky he was through this whole thing. He really thought he could just do all those things and it was never going to come back to him. Courtright then called Cece to the stand. She was his last witness because he said, quote unquote, "You always put the best for last." Cece told the jury about the attack and the long-standing mental anguish she suffered at the hands of Sean Doyle. But she also wanted Sean to see that she was no longer scared of him. He had no control over her. And she did just that. When it was the defense's turn, they attempted to poke holes in the prosecution's case, but there was really nothing they could do. The defense really didn't even have a case. They were just trying to poke holes in the prosecution's case. After 3 days of testimony, the case was handed over to the jury. Jennifer said they were all holding their breath. At that point, it felt like she hadn't exhaled in months, waiting to see what would happen. They needed good news. And despite all the evidence against Sean, it wasn't clear how the jury would decide. There was always a chance that they could get it wrong. On January 26, 2006, after only 2.5 hours of deliberation, the jury came back with a verdict. Sean Doyle had been found guilty of second-degree murder. And Sean Doyle didn't have much of a reaction, but Lori's family burst into applause, excitement, and tears. Cece was so relieved that he would finally be punished, but it was also difficult still for her to wrap her head around the fact that someone that she had once loved had been convicted of murder. 1 month later, at Sean's sentencing hearing, the judge listened to statements from Lori's friends and family. Austin and Zachary were too young to attend trial, but they also both wrote letters to the judge, which were absolutely heartbreaking. And thankfully, Sean Doyle was sentenced to the maximum, 25 years to life, with the possibility of parole. You always hate to hear the "with possibility of parole" part, but that is unfortunately what he got. At least he got 25 to life. But Jennifer really was not happy with this possibility of parole. She didn't think that that was harsh enough. He never deserved to get out of prison. Dorothy Tucker also said Sean was a danger to society, and she hoped he never got out. She felt very betrayed by Sean, whom she had once been very close with. She trusted him, and he had lied to her face. She thought she knew who Sean was, but she couldn't have been more wrong. He was an evil man. And she said she can only hope that Lori's family can forgive her for how she treated them. I certainly can't decide if Lori's family would forgive her or not, but her testifying against Sean for Lori definitely did something, at least in my book. She also recognized that it was a mistake and had no idea who Sean Doyle was. She thought she was just being a good friend. But still, I can absolutely understand why she feels so guilty for doing that at all. They were in the worst possible place they could have been. But I digress. Don Lehman, who was a reporter who covered Lori's case at the time of her murder and had covered countless domestic violence cases, said there are important lessons to be learned from Cece and Sarah's attacks and Lori's murder. He said, quote, "Every case of domestic violence is a potential homicide. They all have to be taken seriously. They all have to be handled in a way to protect these victims." And I totally agree. Cece also hopes that people can learn from her. She said, quote, "Be vigilant, look at what's happening in front of you and make sure someone knows. Don't keep it quiet, pay attention. And when you have that feeling, that one that doesn't go away, you know, the one you try to push down, that's the one you should listen to the most." She has also been able to let go of the guilt she felt for what happened to Lori, because ultimately it wasn't her fault. Lori's sister Jennifer also said she didn't blame Cece for what happened. She said, quote, "She did what she had to do. I don't blame her. I feel sad that she's felt guilt all this time." Which I'm glad that Jennifer said that for Cece's sake, because even if Cece was able to forgive herself, I'm sure at some point there would have been that annoying thought in the back of your brain, what if Lori's family doesn't forgive me? So it's very kind that Jennifer said that because she was only 18 years old. She didn't know how to deal with any of this stuff. She was just a kid. She had been attacked herself, and she was lucky that she didn't lose her life. So my point is that I'm glad that Cece was able to forgive herself and that Jennifer voiced that. However, the hole in Jennifer's heart that Lori's murder left will never be filled, but she wants people to remember her sister for being fun, loving, and very funny. Sean Doyle is still in prison, but he will be eligible for parole in 2030. So hopefully he does not get out, but that is how possibility of parole works. Eventually, they finish their sentence, and then they can potentially get out. So I hope for everyone's sake that that does not happen. And if it does, I hope that Sean Doyle has actually learned something and been rehabilitated. It would be pretty shocking if he had been, but one can hope. I hate leaving it on a bad note, so I will say Cece seems to be doing well now, and I don't know much about where she is now or what she's up to, but she seems to be doing well. And that's great. I also hope Sarah's doing well, because none of these women deserved what happened to them, and they deserve peace. But I think that is all I have to say about that, so why don't we move on to a bit of a palate cleanser and I can tell you my good thing so that we can move on with our days as normal. My good thing is that it is officially Pride Month. Happy Pride to all my gaybies out there, the alphabet mafia, if you will. And it's also officially hot outside. The weather has been gorgeous. The sky has been really showing off. The clouds have been insane. I've gotten out and gone on walks. I've played some pickleball. The good weather is feeling good. It's also the perfect weather to go and touch some grass, which, as we know, is a favorite pastime of mine. Because every once in a while, especially these days, you gotta get outside and touch some grass. But that's my good thing. Anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to check out all of our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Check out my YouTube channel, Steph Today, over on YouTube. I've got a couple videos out now for your viewing pleasure. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy has happened to you and you'd like to share it with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. I'm posting pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is nottodaypodcast and a Twitter that is nottodaypodcast, but the T on that podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.